In the name of God, most gracious, most compassionate, I appreciate your coming here tonight. The topic of tonight's lecture is Mystical Prayer, the Essential Teachings of Rumi. Prayer is a critical component of all world religions. This is particularly so in Abrahamic religions, such as Islam, Christianity, and Judaism. Yet many philosophers and natural scientists have always had a problem with the notion of prayer. Even philosophers who happen to also believe in God, when it comes to the notion of prayer, it seems that there is something about prayer that ticks them off. More specifically, since the time of Isaac Newton, when a new vision of physics emerged in the world, we have been used to the notion of a mechanical world. Everything pretty much works like a clock. And to these philosophers and natural scientists, prayer somehow interferes with the natural course of events. When you ask God to make a change, it's as if you are asking God to alter something that should not be. So that's why these naturalists and philosophers have always had a problem with the notion of prayer. Tonight I will discuss the mystical conception of prayer, how mystics view prayers and how they tend to explain this very important part of the religious and spiritual legacy of humankind. I will draw upon the teachings of Rumi, who lived in the 13th century. He was a Farsi-speaking Muslim mystic, and he had a great influence on world mysticism the world over. His poetry is quite famous around the world. In fact, his books are amongst the bestsellers in the U.S. Obviously, in the West, Rumi is mostly associated with the notion of love. Well, for a good reason, because actually love is the central theme in all of his work and poetry. Yet, his system of thought has other components as well. Another important component of Rumi's system of thought is actually prayer, which I'm going to discuss at length tonight. He has very valuable insights and teachings in this arena. Let me make a couple of notes at the outset. There are a number of Islamic terms or Islamic concepts that they all mean prayer in one form or another. One of them is in Arabic, it's called Salat, which means obligatory prayers that Muslims do five times a day. The other one is in Arabic, dhikr, which means invocation. The third one is dua, which means supplication. Tonight when I talk about prayer, it incorporates all three of them. The second one is that tonight I'm going to recite Rumi's poetry quite a bit. I'm going to recite his poetry first in the original language Farsi, and then I will translate the poems in English. A word of caution, by the way, all the translations are mine. So let me begin with Rumi's notion of prayer. I'm going to organize the lecture in six or seven subsections. So hopefully that will help you follow the lecture a little bit easier. It is very difficult, as you probably know, to box mystics in any particular religion because the focus of mystics is on God, not doctrine or dogma. Rumi is no exception. That's why his teachings are so popular all over the world, just because you don't have to be a Muslim in order to appreciate his teachings. Having said that, I still think that we should not lose sight of Islamic roots of Rumi. What do I mean by that? Well, his teachings on prayer are very much influenced by his Islamic upbringing. As I mentioned before, Islam is part of the Abrahamic or the monotheistic tradition. Christianity and Judaism obviously are the other two siblings of Islam in that category. There are a few important points about monotheism that are important for our discussion tonight. And at the very beginning, I would like to lay them out for you. Number one, in monotheism, the divine or God is viewed as creator. So we have the creator and the created. And there is definitely a line of separation between the two. Now, in the Buddhist theology, that line of demarcation and separation, for example, is not as distinct as the Abrahamic tradition. Secondly, in this tradition, God has personhood. Whenever we're talking about the personhood of God, it means God is distinct from his creation. The second important point about monotheism is that in this tradition, God relates to human beings primarily through spoken word. In other words, the divine or God utters a word, and that word becomes the object of devotion. Humanity's task from that point forward is to somehow realize the word of God in the flawed circumstances of daily life. This is the general paradigm of the monotheistic tradition. And thirdly, men and women can also communicate with God. So not only God speaks, but human beings in turn can speak to God. God hears and responds in kind. So this is the overall framework of the monotheistic tradition, and I believe Rumi's teachings on prayer fits this general paradigm and framework. Now, the first important thing that I want to share with you, or the starting point for our discussion on Rumi's notion of prayer, is that for him, prayer is not a monologue, it is a dialogue. And this is very critical. Most of us tend to view prayer as a monologue. In other words, we speak. And Rumi takes exception with that. He says prayer, in essence, is a dialogue. And this dialogue encompasses both silent prayer as well as talkative prayer. In other words, one can be closed-mouthed and still pray. So that's one form. And the other one is vocal prayer. Now, some of you may have a problem with the notion of silent prayer within the Abrahamic tradition. But Rumi would respond that you shouldn't be surprised, because in this tradition, God or the divine hears all. He hears everything. If you whisper, God hears. Even if you have intentions, even if you have thoughts that are not spoken in tongue, God can still hear. So in that sense, even when you have silent prayer, you sit down and silently you pray, still you can communicate with the divine in Rumi's perspective. And actually, in the higher stages of the mystical journey, silent prayer is a norm. So mystics in all world traditions much prefer to have this dialogue with the divine silently. The second important point is that for Rumi, prayer is rooted in God's grace. Prayer is rooted in God's grace. Let me explain. What does grace mean, by the way? Grace, in simple language, it means unmerited favor. Unmerited favor. Let me give you an example. Suppose you hire me to work for you. I work for a whole day, At the end of the day, you pay me the prevailing wage. Let's say I'm a very skilled worker, you paid me $100 at the end of the day. If you pay me the prevailing wage, you have acted justly. You have done justice to me, because justice by definition means paying what is due. In other words, justice always considers merit and worth, right? Grace, or in Arabic, karam, is different from justice. If you give me $100 without me doing any work for you, that would be a gracious act on your part, because grace does not take into account worth or merit. Even if you don't deserve it, still you can be the recipient of a gracious act. This is precisely what Rumi means when it comes to prayer. Prayer is a gift from God to humankind, even though humanity did not deserve it. Rumi says, این دعا هم بخشش و تعلیم توست ورنه در گلخن گلستان از چه رست. Prayer is your teaching and generosity. How could a furnace cultivate a rose garden? In other words, according to Rumi, if humanity was left to their own accord, men and women could not find God. On their own terms, without divine intervention, humanity would not be able to talk to the divine. Humanity didn't know how to seek God and how to engage God in prayer. In other words, it's as if God allowed us to speak to Him. He allowed us to speak to Him. Rumi says, اذکروا الله شاه ما دستور داد اندر آتش دید ما را نور داد. Our Lord found us in an inferno and saved us with His light. He directed us at uttering His praise. He's very deep and succinct in what he's saying in this poem. He's saying that we were in a terrible state of existence, and then God wanted to save us. He wrote a prescription to us. What was that prescription? His praise. In other words, the act of praising the Lord would put out the fire within. So that is the magic of prayer as far as Rumi is concerned. So God has given us permission to speak with Him. The trouble is we rarely view our relationship to God like that. Rumi uses an analogy to explain his point that it was God who permitted us to speak to Him. Would you ever call the White House to talk to the president, for example, if you feel lonely and heartbroken? Would you ever do that? If, you know, you want to open up to somebody, if you want to confide your situation to somebody, would you ever dial the White House in the middle of the night and say, I want to talk to the president? If you are in your right mind, you would not do that. Rumi would ask the following question, why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you call the White House in the middle of the night if you want to talk to somebody? The answer is very simple. Intuitively, we all realize that we are not on a par with the president. Intuitively, we pick and choose the people that we want to talk to, and those people invariably are at our level. Isn't that amazing? Yet, when it comes to God, who is infinitely superior to the President of the United States, we don't do that. As if we deviate from the norm when it comes to talking with God. Rumi correctly, in my opinion, points out that God has granted us the permission to talk to Him. If God had not given us the permission, we would not even dare addressing Him. Now, to drive this point home, Rumi narrates a story in his masterpiece, Masnavi. He says there was a villager who had a cow. That villager had really bonded with his cow to the point that typically at night he would go to the barn and talk to the cow, very much, you know, like when we bond with our pets, for example. He would go in the middle of the night to the barn, talk to the cow. One night, according to the story, a lion entered the village, went to the barn, and had a great dinner out of the poor cow. Now, the lion was so audacious that he took a nap in the barn, right where the cow used to sleep. That night, the villager did his routine. It was dark, and he couldn't see very well. He went to the barn, and he thought that his cow was sleeping in the barn. So without any delay, he sat down next to the lion at that point and started caressing and fondling the lion, thinking that it was really his cow that was sleeping there. At that point, the lion said to himself, "If this moron knew I were a lion, he would probably wet his pants. این چنین گستاخ زن می خاردم کو در این شب گاو می پنداردم." "He is scratching me so audaciously," the lion said, "because in darkness he has mistaken me for a cow." In other words, Rumi is saying that this relationship between the villager and the lion in this story also applies to our relationship with God. In other words, if we truly pictured God in His awesome capacity, in His infinitely powerful capacity, He would be so imposing that He would overwhelm us and we would never ever dare address Him and talk to Him. اسکرونی اگر نفرمودی زهره نام او کرا بودی. Had he not permitted us to invocate, who would dare utter his name? In other words, if God had not permitted us to speak to him, who would even dare address God in prayer? The fact that we address God at will, the fact that we talk to Him in any form and fashion we see fit, and we never stutter when we talk to Him, is absolutely amazing. But we rarely recognize that. We rarely think our relationship to God like that. There is an important question here that we should discuss. If Rumi is correct that God has given us permission to talk to Him, what form does His permission take? Right? How has God permitted us to speak to Him? Let me explain. Well, according to Rumi, this permission is not by way of a decree. It's not in written form. It's not that God has written a letter to us saying that, yes, you are allowed to speak to me. This permission actually is built into the very fabric of us. This permission of God is built into the very fabric of our creation. How? According to Rumi, by means of forgetfulness. By means of forgetfulness. You see, most often, being forgetful is a bad thing, right? One of the rare instances where forgetful is actually a good thing is when it comes to prayer. We forget the awesomeness of God. We forget His infinite superiority to us because of this forgetfulness, but then we dare addressing God at will, whenever we feel like it, in whatever form and fashion we choose, we start talking to God without any preparation. Prayer, then, in a nutshell, is innate. We are all pre-wired for prayer. Now let me talk about the second important pillar of Rumi's thinking. Prayer fulfills an important human need. Prayer fulfills an essential human need. Not only we have the capacity to talk to God, we also have a yearning for that. We long for that. If you scan all the cultures across the globe, go to India, go to Pakistan, to Europe, to Africa, and here at home in the US, invariably you will find that in every single culture, people have devised unique ways to pray to God. Islamic and Hindu prayers are not identical. Jewish and Zoroastrian prayers are not the same. Yet every culture, in its own unique way, has found a way to enable its people to attempt to communicate with God and somehow connect to God. That is a constant across all cultures around the world. Why do people long to talk to God? Why is this yearning that we have to communicate with God? Well, according to Rumi, the answer is quite simple. There is an element of the divine in every single one of us. There is an element of divine in every single one of us. In the Quranic and biblical terminology, God blew His spirit into humanity. God blew His spirit into humanity. And that's the element of God in every single one of us. And naturally then, our spirit seeks its source. Our spirit is only satisfied when it communicates with the source from which it came from. In other words, our spirit naturally gravitates towards the spiritual center of this universe. Prayer is nothing but that gravitation. So, quite naturally, human beings are oriented towards the divine. We seek God. And when we succeed in connecting with God, then we will attain a measure of inner peace. When we somehow succeed in connecting with the divine, with the source that our spirit came from, then we will attain inner peace. We will attain serenity and tranquility. It's not unlike a toddler who feels insecure and anxious when apart from her mom, right? Exactly the same kind of feeling. This is precisely how the Quran paints the picture for us. In chapter 13, verse 28, we find in the Quran about this connection between inner peace and prayer. الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَتَتْمَئِنُّ قُلُوبُهُمْ بِذِكْرِ اللَّهِ أَلَا بِذِكْرِ اللَّهِ تَتْمَئِنُّ الْقُلُوبُ. Those who have faith and their hearts find peace in the invocation of God. Truly, it is in the invocation of God that hearts find peace. In other words, people will find peace only when they connect with God, according to the verse in the Quran. In other words, our spirit requires nurturing, right? Very similar to our body. Our body has physiological requirements. We need to satisfy those physiological requirements in order to sustain life. Our spirit also has its own requirements. It requires nourishment. Prayer, according to Rumi, is food for our spirit. Prayer is food for our soul. So it is in this sense, prayer fulfills a very important function, a very important role in our overall happiness. The fourth important point that I would like to discuss with regard to Rumi's teachings. Rumi believes that our prayer is actually a response to divine calling. Our act of prayer is a response to divine calling. Let me explain. What Rumi is teaching here is obviously counterintuitive, because ordinarily we think that we human beings initiate the prayer, right? We think that we are the subject, the person who drives this whole communication. Rumi begs to differ with that. In talab dar ma ham az ijad tost, rastan az bidad ya rab dad tost. O God, this yearning is your effect. Relief from anguish is your deliverance. In other words, he's saying that this yearning that we have to pray doesn't come from us. God creates this yearning and this longing in us to communicate with Him. We do not initiate this dialogue with God. No, it is God who initiates this conversation. He invites us for a chat. In contemporary language and analogy, it's as if God dials the number and we pick up the phone. This is the exact opposite of, you know, the way we think of prayer. We think that in the act of prayer, we dial the number and God then would pick up the phone. So, those of you who pray, according to Rumi, should consider yourself very privileged. You are very privileged that you are picking up the phone. It is a privilege. It is an unmerited favor by God. The reverse is also true. Those who shy away from praying, those who turn their back to communicating with God, it is because they are not invited. They are not invited to the party. For those of you who are following the lecture closely, you remember I mentioned that prayer is a gracious act of God, and grace means what? Unmerited favor. It is a privilege, it is not a right. جان جاهل زین دعا جز دور نیست زان که یارب گفتنش دستور نیست. بر دهان و بر دلش قفل است و بند تا ننالد با خدا روز گزند. The ignorant is oblivious to prayer, for he is not blessed to utter, O Lord. Those who don't utter, O Lord, because they are not blessed with that. Those who keep away from calling on God, it is because they are deprived of the opportunity. Now the question is this: how does God invite us to this party? How does God initiate this conversation? According to Rumi, when God wants to invite us for a chat or prayer, He creates a longing in us. He creates a longing in us. Here is a mystical formulation, by the way, for this scenario. It's fairly complex. I'm going to make it very simple. God creates this longing, this yearning in us in exactly the same way that a beautiful beloved creates a yearning, a burning desire in the lover. How does a beloved create a burning sensation, a yearning in the lover? Very simply, she reveals a bit of her beauty to the lover. This very act will awaken love in the lover. You see what's happening? In the same sense, the divine reveals a bit of his beauty to us. He captivates us. And when we are captivated, we start uttering his praise. We start talking and saying, O Lord. This is, in a nutshell, the mystical formulation. In the analogy that I just mentioned, by the way, the beauty of the beloved, think of it as a noose. Obviously, we probably don't like to speak of noose because we think it applies to animals, but actually that's exactly the terminology that Rumi uses. In Farsi, kamand. Kamand in English means noose. He says the beauty of the beloved is really like a noose that wraps around the neck of the lover and pulls him after the beloved, right? That's exactly what happens when God reveals his beauty to humanity. When that happens, we start longing and yearning for God. Now, in the history of humanity, we witness the climax of this longing, the height of this longing in saints and prophets all over the world. Let me explain a little bit. In the Quran, there is the story of Prophet Moses on Mount Sinai. As you all know, when Moses went to Mount Sinai, he saw a burning bush. He approached the burning bush, and as soon as he approached it, the burning bush started addressing Moses. Chapter 20 in the Holy Quran, verses 17 and 18. The burning bush addressed Moses. Moses, what is in your right hand? At this point, probably you don't appreciate this simple phrase in the Quran. God asks Moses, what is in your right hand? It's a very simple and a straightforward question. Listen to the response of Moses to this very simple question. It is my staff, Moses said. I lean on it, restrain my sheep with it, and I also have other uses for it. A very awkward response. First off, God Almighty, the all-knowing, all-seeing God, couldn't see what Moses was carrying in his hand? And more awkwardly, Moses is telling God the functions and the uses of his wooden rod. Isn't that amazing? That's precisely what Rumi picks on in his poetry. He says that Moses lengthened the response to God as long as he could because he really longed to call on God. He really wanted to lengthen this communication and this conversation with God. An opportunity had arisen and he wanted to take advantage of that. He wanted to seize the opportunity and the moment to prolong this connection with God. Rumi appreciates what Moses did in his poetry. همه جمال تو بینم چو چشم باز کنم. همه شراب تو نوشم چو لب فراز کنم. حرام دارم با مردمان سخن گفتن و چون حدیث تو آید سخن دراز کنم. هزار گونه بلنگم به هر رهم که برند و آن رهی که سوی توست ترک تاز کنم. Oh God, your beauty is all I see as I open my eyes. Your wine is all that I drink as I open my mouth. I restrain myself from talking to people. Yet I talk to death when telling your tale. I limp along every way they take me, yet I sprint when I go in your way. In other words, if you're walking on the street and you come across somebody that you don't care much for, what do? You look for any kind of excuse not to talk to that person. And if you have to, you're going to make it as brief as possible. On the other hand, when you come across somebody that you love, somebody that you really care for, what do? You're going to start talking from here and there. You're going to talk about politics. You're going to talk about theology. You're going to talk about, Jack Nicholson. All of that. Because you want to prolong this conversation. Because you cherish the moment. You don't want to let go. Saints, prophets, mystics, people of God, pray frequently and pray for a very long time. Not because they have to, not because it is a religious chore, not because it is an obligation, but because they long for God. They have a yearning to connect to God. And when they do, they cherish that moment. When they get connected to the spiritual center, the spiritual magnet of the universe, that connection takes over their heart and their soul. For them, then time flies. They don't know for how long they have been praying. Now let me turn on to another point in Rumi's treatment of the notion of mystical prayer, which is actually a good response to the challenge that I pose at the very outset of my lecture. Do you remember in the introduction I said that philosophers and natural scientists have always had problem with prayers, you remember? Now, hopefully you will see Rumi's response to that challenge. Rumi argues that there are grades to prayer. There are levels to prayer. Just as there are grades to our maturity, there are levels to our spiritual and emotional development. With the same token, there are levels to our prayers. Our prayers are not all exactly the same. They are at different level. True, some of us have very shallow personalities. Others have very deep personalities, and there are a whole slew of shades that fall in between the two extremes. Some of us, with the same token, are caught in the lower orbits of materialism. Our lives revolve around material gains. For those of us who are caught and stuck in these lower orbits, how do we calculate our net worth? In terms of dollars, isn't that amazing? To be honest with you, I find it extremely offensive when somebody asks me on a financial statement, what is your net worth? We never think about it that way, do we? It's quite offensive when you tell somebody that your worth in life equals the kind of car you're driving, how big your house is, and your address, your home address, basically. Now, those of us who elevate to higher orbits, well, then we will find an appetite for the finer things in life. So suddenly life, successful living, will take on a new meaning. Rumi argues that the depth of our prayer matches our maturity level. The depth of our prayer matches our emotional and spiritual development. At one end of the spectrum or the scale, there are those who pray exclusively for physical wellness and material success. Fact of life, right? The prayers of many of us exclusively involve things related to material success or physical wellness. We are in trouble and we ask God for help. We are in debt. Somehow we can't pay it off. We turn to God for assistance. We have an illness. We can't be cured with the kind of medications on the market. We turn to God for help. Sometimes even we don't study hard enough in college and we turn to God to rectify our tardiness and laziness, right? Sometimes we love our football team to the extent that we ask God to beat down on the team we don't like. So these are all examples of this type of prayer, and we all do it. Rumi says, hang on for a sec. It's not all bad that people turn to God for these kind of requests. آدمی اول حریص نان بود زان که قوت نان ستون جان بود چون به نان درگشت مستغنی ز نان طالب نام است و مدح شاعران. First, man covets for bread. For bread is his sustenance. As bread renders him needless of bread, then he craves for fame and praise. By the way, I think Rumi anticipated Maslow's hierarchy of needs. How many of you have heard of Maslow? Okay, most of you. Basically, some 800 years before Maslow, Rumi taught us that there are levels to our needs and wants, right? Those people who really are poor, they have to go for bread. But as we find our physiological needs satisfied, then suddenly new needs and wants emerge. That's exactly what Rumi is saying here. So, is it really bad to want God in the service of our material advancement? Is it really bad to want God in pursuit of our financial well-being? Rumi's response to this question is quite intriguing. He says that these base materialistic requirements, these base materialistic needs are actually openings to God. These base desires, these base wishes are definitely openings for talking to God. And when these wishes, these requirements are fulfilled, we are exuberant. We get positive energy. And then, for the first time, we get a peek at the kindness, grace, and beauty of God. We become captivated. Rumi uses an analogy to explain his very point about openings to God. He uses actually the analogy of kids going to school. How do we motivate our youngsters at age 5 or 6 to go to school? How do you spark an interest for education in your kid? Would you ever tell your 5-year-old daughter that if you go to school at age 5 or at age 6, someday you will get a PhD in molecular biology and you will find a cure for Parkinson's disease? Would you say that?
No.
You wouldn't. You would never talk to your child at that level. Because at age 5 or 6, your kid cannot comprehend these lofty goals and these lofty ends in life. Her time horizon is far shorter than that. So, what is the best way to motivate our kids to go to school at age 5 or 6, so at age 26 they will get a PhD in molecular biology and do all those good things for humanity? Rumi has the answer. چون که با کودک سر و کارت فتاد همزبان کودکی باید گشاد، که برو کتاب تا مرقت خرم، یا مویز و جوز و پستک آورم. When you are dealing with a child, talk as children talk. Say, go to school so I reward you with a pet, or I get you pistachio, peanuts and pastry. You see, these are the kind of things kids can relate to. At that level, these are a lot more tangible than finding a cure for Parkinson's disease, right? Yet, you and I, as parents, know that these are nothing but silly and childish motives for an education. Still, we also recognize that these childish motives work extremely effectively in children, right? Are you with me? It is really bad at age 30 to go to school for pistachio, peanuts, and pastry. And unfortunately, I'm here to tell you, we all do that. Let me deviate a little bit and vent my frustration. We go to school these days not for education. We should strike out the word education. We go to school these days for technical training. See, technical training is far different than education. Education always brings us wisdom. Technical training will enable you to produce gadgets, not necessarily to be wiser in the choices you make in life. Now that I vented my frustration, let's go back to what Rumi is articulating here. Rumi basically is saying that pistachio, peanuts, and pastry, these are quite effective. They work like a noose to grab the kid and pull her forward so that she ultimately comes up with a cure for all sorts of diseases that we have around. In the Holy Quran, we do find these sort of childish prizes for kids of all ages when they do good things. Basically, this is true of Christianity, Judaism, and all world religions. In all sacred books, promises are made to men and women that if you do well, you will go to heaven. And when you go to heaven, you're going to have a lot of goodies, right? According to Rumi, these are childish motives to do good things. Rumi has gotten his aspirations from the Holy Quran. Chapter 9, verse 72. This is an astonishing verse in the Quran, and unfortunately we rarely pay enough attention to it. Listen very carefully to this verse. God has promised the faithful, both men and women, gardens graced with flowing streams where they will remain, good, peaceful homes in gardens of lasting bliss. In other words, God has promised the faithful that if you keep your faith, if you do gracious acts, you will have beautiful homes in heaven. But then the verse immediately throws in a caveat. وَرِزْوَانٌ مِنَ اللَّهِ أَكْبَرُ ذَلِكَ هُوَ الْفَوْزُ الْعَظِيمُ. And the greatest of all, greater than the garden of bliss, beautiful homes in heaven, and greatest of all, God's good pleasure, that is the supreme triumph. According to Rumi, the first part of the verse deals with kids in the spiritual traditions. The latter part of the verse is addressed to the mature folks, those who appreciate the company of God. See, that's exactly what Rumi is discussing in Masnavi. For beginners, those who have not tasted yet the sweetness of God's company, then the sweetness of a river of honey is a lot more tangible. they can relate to that a lot more easily, because that really corresponds to their state of being and existence. Rumi says that as we mature spiritually, our appreciation of prayer and God in general goes through an enormous and fundamental transformation. We come to appreciate goodness for goodness' sake. We come to appreciate God for God's sake. Let me give you a prayer from a famous lady in the Islamic mystic tradition by the name Rabi'ah. She lived some 1300 years ago in the city of Basra. This great lady says in her prayer, "O God, if I worship you in fear of hell, burn me in hell. And if I worship you in hope of paradise, exclude me from paradise. But if I worship you for your own sake, withhold not your everlasting beauty." That's what Rumi is talking about. When we mature spiritually, we will eventually come to a point where we really appreciate God for His eternal beauty, nothing else. Now, Rumi is a realist, by the way. He recognizes that we all need to start our spiritual journey the way kids start their education. We all need tangible motives or simply a pretext in order to turn to God. Rumi uses a lot of analogies in his masterpiece, Masnavi, to illustrate this point, namely that often small openings will eventually lead to vast opportunities for finer things in life. He recognizes that small motives can lead to giant gains in life. Let me give you a couple of his analogies in Masnavi. Bahrenan shakhsi suye nanva david, dad jan chun husn nanva ra bedid. Someone rushed to a bakery to get bread. She passed out when she witnessed the baker's charm. She went to the bakery to buy bread. As soon as she entered the bakery, she laid eyes on the baker. The baker was so charming, so pretty, that she just, you know, went unconscious. In other words, what Rumi is saying is very simple, that her initial motive was bread, but then she found beauty at the end. رفت موسا کاتشی آرد به دست، آتشی دیدو که از آتش برست. Moses went up to Mount Sinai in search of fire. He witnessed a fire that saved him from hellfire. In other words, Moses went to Mount Sinai in search of finding some woods to build a fire to escape from the cold. In the process, he ended up approaching a burning bush or God that saved him from damnation, basically. What I'm trying to say is this. Rumi does not reject non-spiritual motives in prayer as long as we view them as openings or pretexts, not as the end game, right? We go mistaken when we view these non-spiritual motives as the end game in prayer. Here, perhaps now we can talk about two distinct type of prayers. The first type, I would translate that into English as petitioning prayer. Petitioning prayer. In this type of the prayer, a person would ask God for assistance in material welfare. These prayers take the form of a humble appeal to God for aid and protection. But there is a second type of prayer that we often lose sight of. And the second type is venerating prayer. venerating prayer. This is a higher level of prayer. In this type of prayer, the person is inspired to talk to God. The person seeks affinity, friendship, and intimacy with God, the way Rabi'a expressed in her beautiful prayer. So, at this stage, in venerating prayer, the prayer actually captures our adoring reverence for God. This is the type of prayer that is very important to mystics in all religious traditions. Rumi points out that venerating prayers are much more than praise for the Almighty. These prayers are really about perfection. These prayers are about perfection. Let me give you a verse from the Quran that unveils this aspect of prayer. Chapter 2, verse 186. God says to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, O Prophet, if my servants ask you about me, tell them I am near. I respond to those who call me and pray to me. So let them also listen to my call and believe in me, so that they may walk on the path to perfection. In other words, God has asked us to pray so that we walk on the path to perfection. You may wonder, what is the prayer and perfection connection? What is the relationship between the two? Remember, I started off by saying that prayer is a dialogue between men and women and God. When we keep on praying, sooner or later, friendship and intimacy will appear, right? The more you talk to somebody, the more you get to know that person, the more friendship and intimacy will emerge. And gradually, there will be a sort of fusion or a blending of our personality with divine attributes. That's where the connection comes in. Think of it this way. You cannot soar with eagles if you party with turkeys. Have you heard that? If you party with turkeys, you can never reach a state where eagles fly, basically. If you aspire to elevate yourself emotionally and spiritually, you better start hanging out with God. And prayer creates a space just for that you will attain perfection. This is the kind of prayer that mystics engage in. Their ultimate goal is spiritual maturity and perfection. Unfortunately, the venerating prayer is what is missing in this whole debate between supporters and opponents of prayer. You see, in this debate that we have in our universities and our philosophical circles, we only focus on petitioning prayers. We never bring into the debate venerating prayers that seek to attain us perfection. Let me talk about one more point with regard to Rumi's treatment of mystical prayer and close the lecture. Response to prayers. How does God respond to our prayers? What form and shape God's response to our calls take? You and I, every single one of us, know that petitioning prayers, in other words, prayers to make a change in our material welfare and financial well-being, for example, are not always answered by God. A lot of times we ask God for help in these regards, but it's as if our prayers are never answered. Sometimes these petitioning prayers bear fruit, and sometimes they do not. What should we make of this? Is it that God is incapable of answering our calls for help? Not so according to Rumi. Rumi says, first of all, these petitioning prayers sometimes go unanswered by God because in the real world we live in, not all efforts bear fruit. We make a lot of plans in life, but not all our plans succeed. I am one person amongst another 6 billion people. I have my own wishes and I have my own requests of God. So do 6 billion other people. You know what the problem is? The problem is my wishes and my requests of God are not in line with the wishes and requests of other people from God. A very childish example. I'm a Padres fan because I live in San Diego. Some of you, probably you like the Dodgers, right? When the Dodgers and the Padres play, I pray for Padres to win, you pray for Dodgers to win. They cannot win at the same time, right? That's exactly what Rumi is saying. There are 6 billion planners out there. Our plans are not always parallel to each other. Sometimes they collide head on. This kind of limitation is built in to the fabric of the material world in which we live. We need to recognize these limitations, not of God, but the material world in which we live. Secondly, Rumi says that sometimes it is best that God leaves our prayers unanswered. Rumi narrates a story in Masnadi to elaborate on this point. He says, there was a guy who made a living by putting snakes on display. That was his job. He would go to the nearby mountain, catch some snakes, bring them to the street, put them on display, and make a living out of that. One day, according to this story, that businessman had a proposition for God. He prayed to God, "Oh God, next time I go to the mountain, help me find a really huge snake so I bring it down to the city and make big bucks out of that." Well, his wish came through. In the mountain, he stumbled across a huge snake that didn't move. What he didn't know, that was not a snake, it was a dragon. Secondly, that dragon was not dead, it was hibernating. So he dragged that dragon into the city of Baghdad, and Baghdad, obviously the weather is quite warm. So very slowly, more sunlight hit at the poor dragon, his eyes melted, and guess what? He just woke up. The first thing he did, he attacked the guy who caught him and he ate him alive. Now Rumi says the following: Bas du'aha kan ziyan ast o halak vaz karam mi nashnavad yazdan pak. There are prayers leading to perdition and loss. They go unheard by God due to his wisdom and grace. Sometimes God does not answer our prayer because he is wise and very graceful. Out of kindness, sometimes he ignores our prayers because they are not in our best interest. Again, Rumi has gotten his inspiration from the Holy Quran. Chapter 2, verse 216 in the Quran. وَأَسَىٰ أَن تَكْرَهُ شَيْئًا وَهُوَىٰ خَيْرٌ لَكُمْ وَعَسَىٰ أَن تُحِبُّوا شَيْئًا وَهُوَ شَرًّا لَكُمْ وَاللَّهُ يَعْلَمُ وَأَنْتُمْ لَا تَعْلَمُونَ. You may dislike something, although it is good for you, or like something, although it is bad for you. God knows and you do not. Thirdly, Rumi argues that sometimes our prayers are not answered the first time around, so we keep on praying. We keep on talking. And guess what? That's the whole point behind prayers. So we keep on talking to God. So we keep this line of communication with God open. Now, even though sometimes petitioning prayers go unanswered, the other type of prayer, venerating prayers, are always answered by God. Venerating prayers never ever go unanswered. Let me explain. To elaborate, Rumi narrates the story of a man who used to get up in the middle of the night and pray, and he really enjoyed doing it. One night that he was sleeping, he had a dream. In that dream, Satan came to him and said, "You have been praying for a long, long time. Why is it that God has never answered your prayer?" That was a satanic temptation, right? When the guy woke up, he said, maybe Satan is right. I have never gotten a tangible response from God. By the way, in Arabic, when you make a call on somebody and then that person acknowledges and says that, "Here I am, I hear you," the word for that in Arabic is labbaik, which means "here I am." When you say, "Oh Lord," God would respond, "Here I am." Now, that satanic temptation was very effective in this poor guy. He stopped doing his night prayers. After a while, another night, he had yet another dream. This time around, however, a saint came to his dream and told him, "Why did you stop praying?" This guy responded, "Because I never got an appropriate response from God. I was afraid God just doesn't like me. That's why he ignores my prayers." The saint responded by saying, "My friend, you really do not understand the meaning of God's response to your prayer. You just don't get it. گفتن الله تو لبیک ماست و نیاز و درد و سوزت پیک ماست حیله ها و چاره جویی های تو جذب ما بود و گشاد این پای تو ترس و عشق تو کمند لطف ماست زیر هر یا رب تو لبیک هاست." The saint told that guy, "Your saying, 'O Lord,' is the echo of 'Here I am.' Your saying, 'O Lord,' is the echo of 'Here I am.' And your need, yearning, and longing are my dispatch to you. Your feeling of love and fear, both are my gracious news. Beneath your every 'O Lord' lies a thousand 'Here I am.'" In other words, this guy who'd stopped praying, the thrill and enthusiasm that he used to feel, so he would get up and pray in the middle of the night, that was God's calling on him. God was inviting him to get up in the middle of the night and communicate with him. It was God's message to him that he wanted to talk to this guy. The saint told this poor guy, "Why do you think that God's response should always precede your prayer?" "Because sometimes God's response precedes your prayer. Before you start praying, God has already responded to your prayer. Rest assured that before you utter, 'O Lord,' he has already responded by saying, 'Here I am.'" So in a nutshell, what Rumi says is this: in venerating prayers, God's response is the very act of our prayer. Our calling on him is actually his calling on us. Venerating prayers never ever go unanswered. This answer, however, takes on many shapes and forms. Sometimes the answer of God takes the form of the inner warmth that we feel. We pray, and as a result, we feel joy. We feel enthusiastic. We feel positive energy. That inner warmth we feel is exactly the response of God to our prayer. And sometimes God's response takes the form of enlightenment. In other words, we feel as if God's light has shone on us. So we see better, and we make better judgments in the choices we make in life. And thirdly, sometimes this response takes the form of inner peace. As I mentioned before, we find inner peace. In all these cases, nothing is changed outside us. All the changes take place inside us. And I guess this is what is missing in this debate between the supporters and opponents of prayer. Mystical prayer is not about changes in the outside world. It's all about changes inside us. And this change takes the form of inner peace, inner warmth, and enlightenment. We're running out of time, and I will conclude the lecture with a beautiful poem from Rumi that captures everything that I have said so far. For Rumi, prayer fully captures the God in all view of the world. God in all. In the monotheistic mystical tradition, the belief is that God is in everything and everywhere. Everything that we experience in life, God is part of that. God plays a role in that. Prayer, according to Rumi, fully captures this God in all view of the world. How? Remember, I started off by saying that for Rumi, it was God who taught us how to pray. It is God that initiates the conversation, and it is God that ultimately responds to our prayer. In all of this, we human beings have absolutely no role to play. Prayer is truly a gracious act of God. جز تو پیش کی برارد بند دست هم دعا و هم اجابت از تو است هم از اول تو دهی میل دعا تو دهی آخر دعاها را جزا اول و آخر تو ای ما در میان هیچ هیچی که نیاید در بیان او لورد هم ایلز would we stretch our hand of need to except you. Both prayer and its acceptance are your doing. First, you planted the desire for prayer in us, and then you responded to our prayers at last. You are the beginning and the ending. We sit right in between, an absolute nothingness that cannot be expressed in words. This is, in a nutshell, a nutshell that obviously took almost an hour and 15 minutes, what Rumi has to say about mystical prayer. Mystical prayer, at its core, is about human perfection. This type of prayer does not necessarily make a change in the outside world. All the changes take place inside us, and that change is all about perfection, attaining the attributes and characteristics of God. I apologize if I went over time again tonight, and God bless all of you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.